I'm Mark Feinsand, executive reporter with MLB.com. I had a chance to speak with Dodgers general manager Farhan Zaidi during the final days of spring training at Camelback Ranch in Glendale, Arizona. We discussed his start in baseball, what he learned working with Billy Beane, how tough the road is going to be for a fifth straight National League West title for the Dodgers, and why watching Clayton Kershaw pitch is one of the most stressful parts of his job. Enjoy. Farhan, how'd you land your first job in baseball?
I might take up your whole tape on there explaining that, but
Cliff Notes version.
Yeah, I was in grad school at Cal in an economics PhD program, and you know, was always interested in baseball. Happened to come across the famous or infamous Moneyball book, as you'd have it, and you know, that really struck a chord with me as, you know, I mean, plenty of stories in there about people with unusual paths into baseball, people that didn't necessarily play professionally, people that brought different skill sets to the table. So that kind of book really was my inspiration. I started sending around my resume and really, you know, got a little bit more active looking for a job in baseball. And, you know, despite what I thought was casting a wide net, wound up being pretty serendipitous that I just happened to chance one day across a listing for a baseball operations assistant with the A's, and didn't know anybody over there, had no experience with the organization, just submitted my resume and crossed my fingers, and a few days later heard from David Forrest, and a week after that I was in Billy Beane's office for an interview. So it was a very, very lucky set of circumstances, and I won't bore you with all the details, but yeah, that was pretty much it.
Now, given that Moneyball sort of sparked your interest in this, how surreal was it to be sitting in Billy Beane's office?
Very surreal. I recall a lot, you know, walking into his office and kind of seeing him sitting there, having read this whole book about, you know, him and how influential he'd be in baseball. I also, like, remember the moment he stood up from behind his desk, and he's a big guy. I don't think people fully appreciate that. You know, in my, you know, background, hadn't been around a lot of professional athletes, and so I still remember that feeling of thinking, like, man, this guy is huge.
Well, most people think he looks like Brad Pitt. So,
right. There's that too. I mean, I wouldn't. Say and have him hear that I was, like, struck by his handsomeness or anything like that. But definitely just the surrealness of being in his office, and actually it wound up being a great interview, and we hit it off really well. But yeah, surreal is exactly the right word for it.
You'd held a few different jobs before landing with the A's, including a position in the fantasy sports division at the Sporting News. Did you ever dream when you were working in fantasy sports that you'd have a chance to actually run your own baseball team?
No, you know, it was an aspiration, but, you know, being a numbers guy, if you had asked me to handicap the odds, I wouldn't have gotten too carried away with the chances. You know, I'd worked at a management consulting firm, and this fantasy sports company, which I had a great time at, that was really the closest access that I could get to working in sports. And so I did that for a year, and I wound up going to grad school after that just because the path to a team seemed a little too difficult and distant.
You once said, quote, "It always seemed to me that to work at a baseball front office, you had to have played the game at a high level or been a scout or a coach. It didn't seem like a career you could access from a business background." Right. As you look at the landscape now of GMs, I believe Jerry Depoto is the only one of the 30 general managers who actually played Major League Baseball.
Right.
Why do you think more former players haven't gone the route of front office career after their playing days?
I think some of it is just that the job of general manager has changed. I mean, baseball's become such big business now that, I mean, some of the skill sets you get from other careers and professions have, you know, brought a benefit. I mean, what's very clear is that people that play the game at the highest level are still very influential in the decision-making infrastructure of a lot of front offices. They may be special assistants or vice presidents of, you know, player personnel, different kind of titles. But the GM title now comes with, you know, a lot of administrative and management responsibility, and maybe that's why you've seen a little bit of a trend with that particular title towards people with less conventional baseball backgrounds.
You mentioned that you were a big baseball fan ever since you were a kid. You were born in Canada, raised mostly in the Philippines. How did you first become a huge baseball fan?
It's funny. So my parents didn't know anything about baseball, so they weren't, they didn't put a baseball bat in my hand when I was 3 years old or
right.
anything like that. No story like that. It was actually a family friend of ours who had happened to have gotten their kids involved in Little League baseball. And, one day my mom was just talking to her, and she was like, hey, we should bring your kids too. So that was kind of how I first started playing. And then once you start playing, you catch the bug and, start following it to whatever degree you can, whenever it's on TV, coming to the U.S. for summer vacations and buying up baseball cards and all that kind of stuff. So that's really how the fandom started. But yeah, certainly wasn't really surrounded by it sort of family or friend-wise growing up.
Was it hard to follow it in the Philippines?
It really was. It was a big, growing...
It was on MLB.TV yet.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Some of that internet access stuff hadn't quite crept up, but I would... it was a big deal for me to be able to buy the USA Today. I mean, it was the international edition, which didn't have quite as much baseball coverage as the domestic edition. But, I would save up my allowance and once a week, go out and buy the USA Today. And I would, try to get it on, Monday because the Monday paper would have both the Saturday and Sunday box scores. Or, some days I would get the Tuesday or Wednesday versions, which had the NL and AL statistics.
Yeah, anybody who played rotisserie baseball
exactly,
in the 80s knows
exactly.
that.
So, yeah, I really had to strategize about which days to buy the USA Today with my allowance. And, so that was the kind of way, and 1 year, I think it was like in 1985, I was like 9 years old, I bought the baseball encyclopedia for the first time. And that poor encyclopedia had to last me about 3 or 4 years. So, my stat database was about 2 or 3 years behind before I finally got another one. But, yeah. Had to follow it in those ways that seem very antiquated now.
When you think about now how people can get access on their phones at their fingertips every day, it's amazing to think that you had to wait until Wednesdays to get the National League stats, right? I mean, people think that's a really foreign concept, but we really did that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's funny. It probably, it comes up in front offices a lot now. All of your stat databases are updated in real time, and there was probably some benefit to having databases that only updated once a week or every 2 weeks because it kept you from going crazy over these small sample sizes,
right.
So it was a little bit of a technological safeguard against overreacting to things. But yeah, no, I'm jealous of kids growing up now and the access they get.
Billy once famously said of you, quote, "I'm more worried about losing him to Apple or Google than I am to another team." Have you ever thought about taking your talents to another industry?
I do have... different interests. I mean, I, like I said, was very fortunate to wind up in this job, but, if the A's had decided to go in a different direction or if I hadn't come across that job posting, I'd probably be in economics academia somewhere, and I really enjoyed that. So, I love this job. I'm very committed to, this organization, what we're trying to do here. I guess I would say on the one hand, I have other interests. On the other hand, it would be really hard to ever walk away from baseball. So I guess, that's a question I've thought about, but I don't have a good answer to.
Paul DePodesta walked away from baseball to make the jump to football.
Right.
He's been the chief strategy officer for the Browns for a little over a year. Do you think that could become a trend in sports where executives jump from one sport to another, or do you think he's a unique case?
I think he's a fairly unique case. Obviously, this happens on the business side a decent amount, or maybe even in the PR world. As far as, the operations side, the sports operations side of things, I actually think it's probably getting tougher and tougher to make those kinds of transitions because the information, scouting, infrastructure, all that stuff is getting so specialized. Now, there's a lot of cross-pollination. I have friends that work in the NBA and NFL, and there's a lot of sort of informal sharing of best practices that happens. But, Paul actually had more of a football playing career than baseball
right.
playing career. So in a way, the baseball job was the unusual one and the football job is what he, maybe should have been doing all along or aspired to do all along. I don't think you're going to see that happen that much. It's a pretty special case and somebody with a very special skill set.
You worked for Billy for a long time. What did you take away most from your years with him?
I, I think one of the easiest traps to fall into, or something that can really inhibit your judgment in this kind of role, is just the fear of making mistakes, fear of making a trade that you get burned on, fear of signing a free agent that doesn't work out, and it can really lead to paralysis. And I think if you really look deep inside the soul of any GM, they'll acknowledge there's a lot of that that affects and maybe even impairs their decision making. And so that, you know, is, I guess, what I was able to observe with Billy and try to apply in practice wherever I can, which is to not avoid making decisions because you're worried about them making you look bad, to always operate in the best interests of the organization. And, you know, as a corollary to that, you know, when we'd be making a trade, you know, he'd always say, focus at least as much on what you're getting as what you're giving up. I mean, sometimes in our front offices, there's so much of a conversation on how good do we think this prospect we're giving up could be, rather than saying we're getting this guy that can really help us get over the hump. So I think that mentality, because of the psychology that goes into making decisions in such a public forum, is really important to nail down, and I think he does that as well as anyone in the game.
You pushed hard for the A's to sign Yoenis Cespedes. What did you like most about his game before he got to the majors? You know, besides the fact that he hit the ball 1,000 feet.
Exactly. You know, he was a really exciting blend of tools and performance. I mean, I think that's the gold standard, and there's a lot of talk about saber metrics versus scouting, and so when
we'll
you
get to that,
right? I guess when you have, you know, an evaluation where things line up as they did in this case, you get really excited, and so our scouts were really effusive about him. We did a lot of analytical work on his track record in Cuba. We broke down our scouting reports and really tried to parse out, you know, how our tool grades compared to major league players. And so, yeah, everything lined up. And again, you know, in a market like Oakland, so much of the issue is just access to talent and who will come and play there. And, you know, so I guess it was a combination of tools, performance, and a willingness to sign with us.
Right. We've seen players come from all over Latin America and a lot of different Asian countries at this point. How much untapped baseball talent do you think there is still out there around the world?
It's a really good question. I mean, I, you know, despite my background, this might come as a bit of a surprise, but have been a little bit bearish on baseball globalization just because I think it's really hard to expand into countries where other sports are clearly ahead. And, you know, when you're the second or third or fourth sport in a country, particularly in a smaller country, you're just not going to get the public's attention. You're not going to get the best athletes to be playing that sport. And so historically, I mean, in general, I've been a little bearish on that. Now, you know, with the World Baseball Classic this spring and seeing, you know, how, you know, it really took international baseball to another level that we haven't seen before, you know, I think I have to rethink my stance because it created a lot of excitement. You know, and every time you get a story like Team Israel, which, you know, might not be, you know, a country you associate with baseball, but when a team like that can capture its country's, you know, imagination and do some exciting things, then you've opened up a whole new market. So I think I'm more bullish on it now than I've been in the past.
In addition to yourself, the Dodgers front office includes Andrew Friedman, Stan Kasten, Josh Burns, Alex Anthopoulos, Jerry Hunsicker. A lot of really experienced baseball people there. Can right. too many voices ever be a bad thing?
Right. Well, our beat writers really enjoy this whole 7 or 8 GMs in the front office thing and joke about, you know, how
they know some of your beat writers. I'm sure they do.
Right. They're, you know, they walk in every day and there's a stack of cars on the GM parking spot. you know, it's like in every organization, there's, you know, what's on people's business card and there's how you operate on a day-to-day basis. I think the public, you know, or the broader view of how we operate is, well, this guy's got this title, this guy's got that title, and that's how things operate. But, you know, in any organization, as long as the day-to-day dynamic is collaborative and productive, you know, things are going to be fine regardless of what the titles are. So it's much more about the people than the titles. I know that's kind of a disappointing answer because people want to hear more about, you know, title fighting, but you know, we have a group that gets along really well and collaborates really well, and so, you know, we don't spend as much time thinking about our titles as everybody else does.
Sure. The Dodgers have won 4 straight NL West titles, averaged more than 92 wins during that stretch. Despite the large payroll, the Dodgers haven't won a World Series in nearly 30 years. 24 of the other 29 teams have won their pennant
right.
since 1988. Is there, how much pressure is there to get the Dodgers back to the top?
I think it's mostly self-inflicted pressure. I mean, you know, we feel that responsibility. I mean, I come into the office every day thinking this is a huge market and a proud franchise. It's been way too long since we won a World Series. So I appreciate the reminder, but we remind ourselves of that every day.
I assumed you knew it all, but I laid it out for the listeners. You know?
Yeah, I view it more as a responsibility than as pressure because every team's trying to win the World Series.
Sure.
I think, if anything, we just feel a greater responsibility because of the history of the franchise and the size of the city and how long it's been.
The L.A. market now has 2 NFL teams, two baseball teams, 2 NHL teams, 2 NBA teams. How much competition is there for fans' attention in the market right now?
I just think that the Dodgers occupy a pretty special place in the hearts of the people of Los Angeles, and, you know, anytime I go out, you know, for a lunch or a dinner and you know, somebody's, you know, gives you the thumbs up and says this is the year or maybe something a little less flattering, you know, I love it. You know, not that I enjoy being recognized or anything like that, but it's just a reminder of how much people care and a reminder of how important the job that we're doing is. So, yeah.
You mentioned the scouting versus analytics debate that's been going on for 15-plus years.
Right.
Every team at this point, all 30, have analytics departments.
Right.
It's no longer a thing where some teams are just ignoring it.
Right.
One GM told me recently that his scouts have actually started taking to some of the analytics because the metrics are backing up what they've been saying about
right.
the player all these years.
Right.
Do you think it was important for not only teams but fans and everybody just to get past the whole idea of one versus the other? Since
absolutely.
Every team is using everything?
Yes. I mean, absolutely. I think at this point, you know, every team, how they evaluate players, it's just about having a differentiated strategy. Because you're right. Everybody has access to the same information. Everybody has scouts that are going out there and seeing the same players. And, you know, I guess, you know, the... when you talk about differentiated strategies, all you need to do is look behind the plate at, you know, during one of these games and you see, you know, 30 radar guns going up. It's like, everybody's getting that radar gun reading, but what are they doing with it from that point on? And that's really become what's relevant is not just are you using the stats, are you using your scouts, but how are you using them and how are you using them differently?
It seemed at the beginning anyway that analytics seemed to be something that small market teams are using to try to get an advantage
right.
to try to catch some of the teams that had a lot greater financial resources. Now that everybody's caught up with that, do you think teams, both small market and large, are out there looking for the next big wave, the next big thing that's going to try to give them a competitive advantage?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, we spend a lot of time on it. Again, it comes back to this notion of differentiated strategy. And being an analytics-driven team, you know, like, say, the A's in the early 2000s, that was a differentiated strategy. Now it's not, because everybody has that same information. You know, whether it's about, you know, how to keep your players healthier, I mean, that would really create a competitive advantage, which is why there's a lot of time and energy and money being spent on, you know, player nutrition and you know, medical health care. You know, so that's just one example of an angle that people are exploring as a way to try to get a little bit ahead. But, you know, having, you know, better analytics than other teams, you know, I personally don't view that as any sort of differentiated strategy at this point.
At this point, analytics are widely available to fans.
Right.
How do you think StatCast is changing the way fans are watching the game?
You know, it's interesting. When I first started with the A's, I would chart our games. So, you know, every pitch, you know, you'd have, you know, a video clipping tool and you would, you know, clip the video for that pitch and you watch it back a couple of times and make sure you got the exact pitch type and location, exactly right. And I did that for a couple of years, and that really changed the way I watched the game. Because like it was almost like I just have that sort of grid of the strike zone embedded in my head, and that's sort of what I see whenever I'm watching the center field camera now. And so I think StatCast, you know, when you see those visualizations of a guy's break and, you know, route efficiency and all this kind of stuff, even when people are watching a regular play, they're going to be paying attention to that sort of stuff. So I think just having those tools and having them show up on telecast is really going to just, you know, particularly on the defensive side of the ball, make people more attentive and appreciate great defense all the more.
Let's turn our attention to the 2017 team a little bit. Dave Roberts won Manager of the Year last year. What to you, what's his best attribute as a manager?
His best attribute is just his energy and positivity, which I would kind of roll into one. I mean, it's such a long season, and there are so many times when it's tempting to just emotionally roll over and be a little negative, or you know, just give in to the frustration. And I've never been around somebody who's more persistently positive or energetic, or knows that things can turn around on a dime. So that kind of thing becomes infectious, and it has a lot of positive downstream effects in terms of guys not giving up in the middle of games and guys being willing to sacrifice for the good of the team. Yeah, so I mean, I think it's the fundamental trait that makes him a really great manager, and he has plenty of others as well.
Corey Seager won Rookie of the Year Award last year, finished third in the NL MVP vote. He's still only 22 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Has he even scratched the surface in your mind how good he can become?
Well, if he hasn't scratched the surface, then I think other teams are probably in trouble. it's interesting. People think about guys peaking, you know, at age 27, 28. That's been the sort of conventional wisdom. Now, with amateur baseball being so advanced and guys, you know, racing through minor league systems quicker, like, I'm not sure that paradigm holds anymore. So, you know, that was one of the debates we had when, you know, we were wondering whether to call Corey up in September of 2015 is, you know, do we want to, quote-unquote, start the clock on him? Do we want him from ages 21 to 27 or 24 through 30? I mean, what's the right time frame where you want a player like this? And you know, one of the arguments we made is, you know, he could be reaching his peak early. I mean, different guys reach their peak at different times. Now, I hope that's not true. I hope he's only scratched the surface, because then, like I said, look out. But, you know, he would also be thrilled if he just maintains what he did last year. I mean, being a top three player in the National League is pretty good.
What is it like to watch Clayton Kershaw take the ball every 5 days for your team?
I mean this as the highest of compliments, but it's almost more stressful, because there's such an expectation of winning when he takes the mound that it's like there's only downside. You know?
Right. If he goes out there and throws a shutout, well, you expected him to do
right,
that, right?
Exactly. Now, yeah, I mean, now that's the burden of expectations that being the greatest pitcher of your generation comes with. So I guess that's the front office stress associated with having such a great pitcher and a guy that the team really relies on to be a stopper. But every once in a while, when you can step back and just be a fan and appreciate the greatness, it's pretty incredible.
How important was it to keep both Justin Turner and Kenley Jansen in Dodgers uniforms?
It was huge. I mean, it was, you know, it was plan A, and, you know, I'm still not sure we ever figured out what plan B was. You know, both on the field and off the field, you know, how important those guys are to us. And again, you know, we talked earlier about the responsibility of bringing a World Series championship to Los Angeles, and those guys having been in the organization for as long as they had, and, you know, in JT's case, being from the area, I think those guys feel that responsibility all the more. So, you know, that's what we want. We want guys that feel that responsibility in turn, you know, to the city and the organization, you know, and to themselves.
You traded for Logan Forsythe this winter. Why did you think he was such a good fit for your club?
You know, there are the sort of paper reasons for it, being a right-handed hitter who's always hit lefties well, you know, being a good base runner, being a versatile defender, and a guy that, you know, can be moved around the diamond and up and down the lineup. That, you know, that's something that, you know, we have tried to emphasize in our roster building, is having that kind of flexibility and versatility with your players. And I think even we underestimated how good a fit he was, because, you know, I've never seen a player come in and fit into a clubhouse as quickly or positively as he has. And, you know, if you get the chance to talk to other people around the team, I think they'll echo that sentiment. You know, he couldn't have done a better job integrating himself into the clubhouse. And, yeah, he already feels like such a fundamental part of the team.
Julio Urias became the youngest pitcher in history to start a playoff game last year. What did you learn about him watching him as he got to the big leagues for the first time?
You know, having seen him pitch in the minors, I think we all knew what the upside could be. I think what we learned seeing him in the big leagues was how quickly he was going to adapt, you know, at the highest level when he needed to make adjustments. You know, when you take a look at what he did in his first two or three starts, which was were a little rough, and how his performance took off thereafter, you know, it was really impressive. And we were trying to monitor his innings, so he's kind of in and out of the rotation and went into the pen a couple of times. And just his ability to adapt to those different roles and make the adjustments he needed to as the season rolled around, I mean, that gives you all the more confidence that he can reach that ceiling.
Year one can often be a transition season for a player coming over from Japan. Do you expect Kenta Maeda to be even better this season?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was, you know, a really incredible season for him, and I think exceeded even our expectations of him. But, you know, I do think he wore down a little bit towards the end of the season and in the playoffs, and I think that's something we're going to have to be more aware of this year. And we have the pitching depth to do it, is to get him a couple of more blows so he's as strong in September as he is in April. You know, and again, for a team that has postseason aspirations like we do, you know, that's the part of the season you're really playing towards. So I think that's what we're going to keep an eye on. But he's coming to camp, you know, stronger and bigger than he was last year. So I think he has that same goal in mind.
Some of Yasiel Puig's numbers have mostly dipped in each of his last three seasons. And again, he's still only 26.
Right.
What does he need to do to become a more consistent player, do you think?
He's got to stay healthy. I mean, I think that's been, I mean, by my view, maybe the biggest, been the biggest issue for him over the last couple years has been just the starts and stops that have come from, you know, the injuries that he's had. So that's been an emphasis for him conditioning-wise this offseason. I think if he can have a season where he stays off the DL, you know, you're going to see, you know, a really big and important contributor to our team.
Why do you think he's been such a polarizing player?
You know, in a sense, I think he was a victim of some of his early success, because I think it created both unrealistic expectations publicly, but also put all the more emphasis on him from the opposition to figure out how to attack him and how to get him out. And there's no doubt he's getting pitched to differently now than when he first came into the league and nobody really knew who he was. You know, I think, you know, now that, you know, he's experienced some highs and some lows and has come in with an appreciation of both, you know, hopefully, you know, some of that stuff starts balancing out and you get a more consistent, you know, person and player on and off the field.
We've already talked about a couple of the guys you developed and brought up to the big leagues. How do you assess the state of your farm system right now?
It's been pretty exciting, and you know, I think you've talked to 28 other GMs so far, and I'm sure everybody feels the same level of excitement for their minor leagues. And this is really a time of year when you can get enthusiastic about it, because you get a chance to see guys from your minor league side come over and pitch and play in big league games, and you know, they always wind up doing things that excite you. We had a kid that we drafted in the second round last year, Mitchell White, come over and pitch in a game about a week ago, and you know, he was throwing 94 to 97 with plus secondary pitches, and you know, one of the most satisfying parts of the job, at least in spring training, is when you bring a guy over from the minor league side and you come back into the clubhouse after the game and your coaches say, "Where have you been hiding that guy?"
Right.
And we definitely got one of those that day. Yeah, I mean, we feel good about it. We think we have some really high-end pitching and some position player prospects that are going to get integrated into the team over the next couple of years. you know, we're going to continue to have playoff and World Series aspirations. So guys will come up when they're ready to help us do that and not before that. So you know, it's a little bit of a balancing act for us, but we're excited about the pipeline.
Last question for you. We talked about four straight division titles. How challenging is number five going to be? How do you assess the state of the National League West right now?
It's going to be, I think, it's going to be a tough division. You have the Giants who are, you know, always sort of right there with us. And, you know, I think bringing Melanson in is, really going to stabilize the, you know, end of the game for them where they had some issues last year. And, you know, I think probably when they do the math of how many games behind the division they finished and how many saves they blew, they probably feel like with a better closer they should have won the division last year. And then you've got the Rockies and Diamondbacks who are both teams that gave us trouble at times last year, have a lot of good young talent, and, you know, made some moves this offseason that I think will make them better and in some ways tougher opponents for us. And, you know, the Padres, we'll see. They've got, you know, they're going with a laboratory approach. We don't know what kind of, pitching we're going to be facing, if they're going to be pulling starters after three innings and matching up from that point on. And, sometimes the opponents you know least about can wind up being the most difficult. And, you know, they're the team we're opening with. So it's going to be interesting. But, they have an eye for the future, but they still have plenty of talent on their big league team. So, that's a roundup of the division. I think it's going to be an interesting and difficult race for us.
Farhan, appreciate the time. Good luck this season.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks, Mark.